From the Ante Up headquarters in Tampa Bay, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now, here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's July 2nd, 2021. You're listening to the best PokerCast on the internet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Was this a nail biter, Scott?
Well, yeah, I would say when I first heard this announced, I was like, all right, this is advertising money because it's probably not going to hit. But you know, when you set big guarantees, you know, sometime, I mean, obviously you want to cover it, but if you don't cover it, it becomes an advertisement expense, right?
Yeah.
Like, hey, yeah, but there's a $10 million guarantee that's not going to get hit, so let's all roll down to the win. But yeah, so I will say I am completely shocked at how well it covered the guarantee. So that is the story today. So when Las Vegas director of poker Ryan Beauregard was sweating a little on Saturday afternoon, but was all smiles on Sunday as the resort cleared its massive $10 million guarantee tournament. The $10,000 event drew 1,328 entries, easily surpassing the guarantee. The winner to be crowned today, depending on when you're listening, will get $2 million in change, and the runner-up will also be a millionaire.
So what do we think this means for poker? I think this is not only a huge positive sign, but it probably means that, you know, the poker community is probably back. I can't imagine, if he missed it terribly, then it'd be like, okay, people are still scared or there's not enough. But we're talking about Las Vegas when people aren't out there for a series right now, really, right? And they're still hitting a $10 million guarantee. I think this is huge news for the community, and I think that just means that unless something crazy happens with this variant and things start, you know, these variants and things start to shut down again, I think the worst is definitely behind us, and we're probably very close to being back to normal.
Very, yes, very clear that that's what's going on here, which is great. Just to put some perspective on it, though, I mean, this was, as far as I can, I've noticed, the first $10,000 buy-in event since we've come out of COVID. So there was a little bit of novelty there. While tournament series are coming back, you know, our In-Up World Championship's coming back in August, there's been several other ones, there's still not the number of events out there that there were pre-COVID, right? So, so, you know, if you're looking to play, you're going to go to those rooms that have them. So those rooms that have them are going to be busier than probably, theoretically, they would be in a normal world, right? So, so there's that. But at this point, I mean, we're just happy that the rooms that are open, which is 256 or so now, the rooms that are doing tournaments, and the rooms that are packing people in, which seems like all of them. So
it's only going to encourage the other rooms now to be like, okay, look, the Wynn made a $10 million guarantee and made it. You know, I think we can feel comfortable starting series again, or we feel comfortable starting guarantees again, or whatever it is. It seems like this is going to be the thing that gets the ball rolling and the snowballing. You know, I know the World Series is obviously helping in that situation as well, but this was a pretty massive tournament, and it worked out beyond probably what their expectations were. So very happy for them, and kudos to Ryan for doing this.
Yeah, one last mention on Ryan, because for whatever reason, Moneyball has been like on nonstop repeat on my movie channels, so I've been watching it. But one of these articles mentioned that the deal with the Wynn was that if he missed the guarantee, it came out of the poker room's budget, not out of the resort's budget. And so the poker room's budget, way smaller than the Wynn's overall budget.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it just seemed like the point where Brad Pitt told the owner, hey, I'm going to pay for Ricardo Rincon, but then I get the money back when I sell him for more next year.
So. I forget Brad Pitt will play Ryan Beauregard in the movie, I guess, when this Lucky Me Too.
Lucky Me Too. Starring Matt Savage.
Starring Matt Savage, of course.
Our resorts world, Las Vegas, the first new Las Vegas strip resort to open since the Cosmopolitan, includes a 30-table poker room with a number of poker rooms still closed from COVID, some permanently. It's a shot in the arm for the game. The room also has cardless players club. Has a cardless players club system on your smartphone.
So that's cool. I mean, one of the things that I, when you and I did a lot of traveling together for poker, one of the things I hated was, oh, I got to bring my card, and you know, or you got to sign up for, you know, I hated that. And then ultimately I stopped traveling for poker, and then like the shelves in my office were like full of these plastic cards that are worthless now because I don't ever go back. But if you have it on your phone, you know, and it transfers, that I like that idea. That's cool. It's smart.
Yeah, I mean, really, it seems almost pitiful that it's taken until 2020 for somebody to come up with this. And not just in poker, but everywhere. I mean, I've got one of those George Costanza wallets, you know, where I'm like sitting on one side.
Yeah, exactly.
And I've queried my friends on Facebook several times. I'm like, help me thin this down. I'm so envious of those of you that pull out like a super thin wallet. But I'm like, how do you do it with all the cards? And I'm like, and I literally listed the ones I have, and I'm like, it's not like I'm carrying around like a Chomsky Big and Tall card, right? I mean, it's like my credit cards and a couple other cards that are necessary, right? But if we could just get all that digital, my rump would be happier. So
and your back too.
But yeah, you're so right. I'm like, you know, it's we have like a little section of our office that had all of our Players Club cards when Laura and I used to go all the time. And I remember a time where we'd get ready to go to make our annual trip to Vegas together, and I'd sift through them. I'm like, all right, which ones are we going to go to? Because I can't take them all because there are like 4 million of them.
Yeah.
And then eventually I'm like, forget it. I'm not even taking any cards. I'm just going to go and sign up for a new card every single time. And imagine that expense to the resort. But that's what happens when you make people bring in all these stupid cards, right? And now you don't have to worry about it. Now, you know, hey, I've got the I'm sure this is on an app too, right? So, which is going to just help generate more revenue for them as well too. I mean, that card doesn't do anything for that, right? I mean,
right.
Nothing on it, but if you have to go to the Resorts World app and, you know, get push notifications on, you know, new dinners or new shows starting or whatever deals are going on, or not even deals, just reminding you what's going on, because I'm sure Resorts World is not going to be doing any deals as massive as that is right now.
Right.
Very smart and really not that hard. So I really hope that's a trend that spreads quickly through all the other poker rooms.
And of course, we just spent the last 10 minutes talking about something that's not, you know, the most important thing here is that they're opening a new casino with a new poker room, which is fantastic, with all the other ones that are staying shut or just shutting down. And this is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, really, yeah, so many of them that have closed down. Again, we don't have a good number of how many have permanently closed down, because a lot of the resorts aren't saying that the room's permanently closed down. But you can kind of get the sense. I mean, I check these websites every week.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And I could tell the ones that there's no movement, and then the ones where they at least still have poker listed on the website.
So, right.
So you're saying there's a chance, right? So, so you know, to open a new resort and then include a, which sounds like a really state-of-the-art poker room as well, too. 30 tables is a nice size in a highly competitive area for poker as well, too.
Right.
Is a really big deal, I think. Now, you know, again, if you want to play a glass of half empty, what I would say is this is a massive, massive resort. It's like 3,000 hotel rooms over 3 buildings, and I forget how many pools and everything. It is
enormous,
true exciting resort.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's almost like, probably you could argue it's almost stupid of them not to have a poker room, because it's just so big. I mean, why not throw 30 tables in somewhere, right? So
yeah.
So we have everything to offer, but. But yeah, they very easily could have just said, hey, we don't need poker now. And, but they didn't. So fantastic. We look forward to seeing how that all runs and what how the Vegas scene shifts. Remember? Cause it's like, you know, it used to be like Bellagio was the place, right? And yeah. Then Venetian opened, and then Aria opened. And so things have moved around. And before that, the Mirage, remember Mirage?
Right, Mirage. Yeah.
Mike McDermott was going to.
That's right.
It's even a poker room now. And the last time it did, it was like a 2-4-3-6 limit room, right? So, yeah. So the changing landscape will be interesting to watch on this as well. So.
Cool.
All right. Phil Ivey is in the NFT game now. The poker legend is offering 5 non-fungible tokens, 1 for each of the paint cards and the ace. Prices range from $199. For the 10 card featuring Ivy's WSOP bracelets, up to a starting bid of $4,000 for the ace. And if you're able to get all 5 cards, you'll be invited to a private charity poker game with Ivy on a yacht in Miami.
So, okay, I did a deep dive into the internet on these non-fungible tokens. And the best thing I can come up with was a limerick from some guy. He's the Limerick King on Twitter. And it said, the NFT market has grown as eight-figure auctions have shown. The overall price is a worse climate crisis for art you pretend that you own. That's essentially what's going on here. I just don't get it. And, it's like they say how these things would be one of a kind. But, I mean, they're digital things, so you could literally duplicate it and then sell it again as the original. And there's no way to authenticate some of this stuff. And it's just, it's just like Bitcoin and crypto, any crypto. I can't wrap my head around this stuff. And some of it makes sense, like if they're saying, well, you know, they can sell prints of a Monet, but only one person can own the original. And it's like, okay, but there are people out there who spent their lives learning how to verify legitimate pieces of art. Is there going to be classes now on this? Right?
Well, okay. So, the one thing I will say, this is all blockchain. So, if you're into the blockchain community, then you feel like that's justified there, because that's what blockchain is, that, there can only be one of that in there. So that's a little bit different than the Pawn Stars guys, taking a look at it and saying, hey, yeah, this is worth $1 million, or no, sorry, this is a reproduction, and your wife's going to kill you because you spent $12,000 on it, right? So there is that to it. A lot of this is just kind of really crazy speculation. Like, I was talking to a friend last night that's he's day trading crypto. That's what he does for a living now.
Wow.
Living in quotes, but, and I'm like, so I was joking with him. I'm like, hey, man, I haven't lost any, or haven't made any money on crypto yet, but I haven't lost any because I haven't bought any. And then he started laughing, and I'm like, but everybody I know that's in crypto says they make money. And I'm like, just got to say, somebody's going to be losing money.
Yeah, that's right.
Not everybody can make money. And he's like, yeah, I know. Somebody is. I'm like, all right. So I don't know, but we'll see. So here's the thing. So the NFTs have been, we've laughed about this on the show before, and I don't want to sound like we are the guys in the balcony of the Muppet Show.
Right.
But this is where it kind of made sense to me here, right? Because now if you get all five of these cards, you're going to be invited to a private charity poker game with Phil Ivey on a yacht in Miami. I mean, come on. How amazing is that, right?
Right.
So to me, this is kind of like bringing the NFT into the Pokemon thing, right? Which I didn't really get Pokemon either. People running around taking pictures of nothing in parks, right?
Right.
But now I kind of get it. I'm like, if this is where they're going with it, so that's something that's exclusive that you can enjoy, right? And I'm not saying art collectors that have a Monet on their wall don't enjoy owning it, but there's only so many times you can look at it, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't do anything. But to be able to say that you play poker with Phil Ivey on a yacht in Miami, that would be worth spending some money for, even if you don't believe in the rest of this NFT.
Because you're trying to make it tangible.
Yes.
Right? In other words, like, yeah, you can pick up your, they call it a wallet for these NFTs, and you can show people, look, I own, but it means nothing, in the grand scheme of things, unless you enjoy looking at them yourself. And it's all about, it seems to me, about ego too, a little bit, saying that I own this. You may have copies of it, but I own the original art of it. And then I read this huge article on it, and they were talking about how people would try to prove, that, okay, so you may own a copy of it, but I own the original, just like I own the original Monet and you don't. But you can't stop me from making copies of it. Yeah. Like, if it exists on the internet, it's there forever, and you're never going to stop people from, So even like the article that I read, they were showing like this cat that sold for $170,000, and it was just an image of a cat that was an NFT. And I'm like, well, I can right now do a screen grab of this cat and put it in my wallet, and I don't own it, but I can tell people I own it. Who's going to do the work? So, it's some of that stuff is silly. And it's the same with the Monets and stuff. I mean, you could get a really good, ripoff and say you own it, and then have somebody, have the stones to try to prove that it's not really a Monet and all that. But So I guess there's a lot of similarities in the art industry or whatever, whoever you want to call it. But most of it seems to me like it is sort of ego driven, that you can say you own it and it's in your NFT wallet or whatever they call these wallet, blockchain wallets or whatever. And I don't know. It's just, it's hard. It's so intangible for me that I like that you try to put a tangible spin on it, but that's just us proving that we don't get it. You know what I mean?
You said something interesting, though. You said that if you enjoy owning this, I think really it's also that your friends are people who enjoy this as well, too, right?
I guess.
Like, for example, if I went to somebody's house and they had a really impressive art collection, I'd be like, all right. I'd be looking at the wall. I'm like, this is awesome. I mean, I wouldn't turn down an amazing art collection. I appreciate art, right?
Yeah.
I'm not going to pay money for it. So when I'm looking at somebody else's wall, I'm thinking of all the cars that I would buy with that money.
Right.
I'm not impressed by it, right? And I'm sure people would come to my house and see the crap that I spent money on, all this Lita Ford crap around here that I think is really valuable. And they're like, and they'd be like, all right, look at the car I could buy with all that, right? So, you know, it depends on the society that you walk in. So if you were in an art collection society, then yeah, there's a keeping up with the Joneses kind of thing where you have to be keeping buying this art and the prices keep going up because that's how you impress your friends, right? And so if you're in an NFT community, I get it now. I get it. If everybody you associate with thinks this stuff has value, then it has value. I mean, it doesn't have value to you and me because we don't care, but to those people it does. So that's what's fascinating to me about both this, the art, in these collection kind of things. At the end of the day, something, whatever it is worth whatever somebody's willing to pay for it. And that's it.
I 100% agree. And then, so, you know, it's like when I used to go to Rush concerts, you know, we were all like-minded people all getting contact highs, you know, because we all like this music, because I'm not going to find a lot of people in the everyday society that like Rush. So I used to love going to those concerts because we all agreed. Same thing with the NFT. If you have friends who like NFT and you like NFT, and now it's like kind of a game or a society or whatever, then I agree with it. It's like my bonsai now with the trees, you know. We have so many friends now that are into it that, you know, we love going to each other's houses and seeing each other's collections and helping each other with their trees and vice versa. It's the same kind of thing. And it's like poker, you know. Well, like-minded people playing poker. It's the same thing. We loved our home game and we all got together. We may not be friends on the outside world, but we are in poker because we all love poker and we all get around, you know, to play with each other and have fun and bust each other's stones. So, you know, yeah, I get it. It's just, I don't get it in that for me, but yeah. I get it for if you want to collect it and be a collector, you know. So I like Ivy's idea too.
Yeah, so you don't have to get it for yourself. You just have to understand that other people get it.
Yeah, I just don't understand why Ivy's doing this. He doesn't need that money.
A lot of money out of this. I mean, here's the thing. We joked about it on the show, and I'm still working on this auction, folks. I am. I'm going to get to it soon. But, you know, if I could come up with something that I thought people would pay for as an NFT, I would be doing this tomorrow. Because I've always said that's the way the easiest way to make money is to find something that you think is ridiculous, but somebody else will pay a lot of money for, and just do that, right? I mean, you don't have to, like, believe in it. You just, if somebody wants to, somebody thinks this stuff is worth a lot of money, all right, well, let me figure out how I can create one of them that they think is worth a lot of money.
So I could take, like, the original digital recordings of our show, the actual originals,
yes,
and sell them as NFTs for us. Because I have them. I think I still have them somewhere. The original ones, like not the MP3s that are degraded that everyone's downloaded over the years, but I have, like, the original, you know, Dave Morrison editing, you know, Audacity file that, Audacity, you know. Yep. So, I mean, we could put that somehow into an NFT and sell it. You got to find out who wants to spend, you know, a couple million for it. But, you know.
That's the difference. So,
yeah. But we could do it.
We could do it.
All right.
A judge awarded Veronica Brill, the poker player who first made known her concerns about Mike Postel's play during live stream events, $27,745 in legal fees from Postel's withdrawn $330 million lawsuit. Brill and Todd Whittles, who earlier was awarded just shy of $27,000, were the only two of the 12 people named in Postel's suit to even respond to it. So this should finally be the end of the saga. Of course, we know it won't be.
Yeah, right.
However, the judgments offer no mechanism for collection, so that will be the responsibility of Brill and Whittles.
Yeah, I think it's Todd Whittles, even though it's spelled that way. It's like Brett Favre, but I'm not sure. But this just cracks me up. I mean, when you think about how much money they sued this guy for, or how much money that they incurred in legal fees, and still nothing's happened. You know, I would have rather have had that $27,000 and, you know, and bought into main event twice.
A couple fascinating things that came out of this. One, well, not so much fascinating because we talked about this, but proof that they have to collect. I mean, they didn't get a check from the judge, right?
Right, exactly. So,
good luck collecting on that, because it sounds like that's going to be impossible. And then two, I'm like, you know, I wondered about this because there are some big media companies involved or named in this too. And the fact that they, who usually have an overabundance and have lawyers on a retainer and will make sure that this stuff, you know, is taken care of, didn't even bother to respond. You kind of wonder whether these two should have taken a page from that and realized that this is just a ridiculous lawsuit that had nowhere to go.
Yeah.
And then they would have saved their legal fees, which they both filed for almost $60,000. So whether the law firm actually charged them that or not, or is only going to charge them the $27,000 that they won, or whatever, I don't know. But would have saved yourself a lot of time and money. Now, obviously, I'm not suggesting that you just ignore lawsuits, but because if it would have gone somewhere, then you would have been in trouble, probably a bigger trouble with it. But it is interesting that 12 people or entities were named, and only two actually thought that it was serious enough to get a lawyer.
Yeah. All right, any updates? Papes, the Antiup Fans free online tournament series on PokerStars Play Money site, is available everywhere. Details how to join can be found at bit.ly/PAIPS. Games run at 6th, 16th, and 26th of every month and rotate disciplines, with a main tournament followed by a second chance event. PokerStars lets you claim 15,000 free chips every 4 hours. Join the Antiup Fans group Facebook page and post within the group to get feedback on hands, ask call the floor questions, or just discuss anything poker. Check out our 11 vintage Antiup logo designs on merchandise at antiupmagazine.com/shop to buy t-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, phone and laptop cases, coffee and drink mugs, and more with your choice of Antiup Magazine, Antiup PokerCast, or Antiup Poker Tour logos. If you have a hand of the week, listener spotlight, or call the floor submission, email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com or post in the Antiup Fans group on Facebook. Find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and you're not sure what the proper ruling should have been? Email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. We'll have Rivers Casino Schenectady Director of Poker Elliot Schechter tell you how he would have ruled. That is a mouthful these days.
It is, right?
Holy cow.
Can you go to this poker room next time?
Exactly. Steve Pavlicek says, in our home game tournament, blinds are 100-200. Two players get into a big hand, and on the river, the pot is about 7,000 chips. Player A announced, I bet 6. Player B announces call. Player B wins the hand, but there's discussion at the table as to what the final bet should be based on the verbal announcement of 6. Is it 600 or 6,000? Player A states they intended to bet 6,000, but would be happy to be held to the 600 chip bet if required to. Player A was held to the 6,000 chip bet on the river. They stated that it was their intention to bet this, and most felt a 600 chip bet made no sense with the size of the pot.
All right, here we go. So Steve actually sent us two call the floor, so we'll do another one next week, and then we have another one reserved that somebody else sent. And Elliot's busy unpacking boxes in New York, so
right.
This one I could handle, I think. So this is a Scott Says instead of Elliot Says. But trust me, Elliot will be back here as soon as he gets set up there in New York. All right, on this one, Poker TDA Rule 57, which got a lot of discussion two TDA summits ago, says a single number bet is ruled as, quote, the highest reasonable amount that does not exceed the size of the pot. So in this situation, the ruling would be 6,000. Had the pot only been 5,000, though, then the bet would have been 600. So, Steve, your floor ruled correctly. But again, it's a good reminder to all you players out there, don't say 6. Say 600 to 6,000.
Yeah.
And because just because this is the TDA rule doesn't mean it's always going to be interpreted that way in your poker room. So the best way to be clear about what you intend is to not use the stupid shortcuts.
Exactly. Scott loved to say that when we used to teach poker 101. You know, be verbal and say the actual number. You know, don't just, take shortcuts. People only get in trouble with that.
It's the 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock on the wheel, driver's ed, right? No one likes it, but...
Somebody told me that they want it 3 and 9 now.
Well, 3 and 9 gets you there a little later, so.
We have a new O'Malley's move. Here it comes.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are back at the old 5-cent, 10-cent, No Limit Hold'em home game. The buy-in here is $20, and the game is five-handed. We all know each other very well, as we play in this game regularly. There is one maniac, one inexperienced player, one solid player, and one speculative player. The small blind posts. We're in the big blind. We have been having a good night so far, as we have doubled our buy-in and are the big stack at the table. We post. The under-the-gun calls, the plus one raises to 40 cents. This player is the speculative one, but knows how to play the game. He usually ends up with more money than he came with. He started the hand with $12, down $8. The button folds, the small blind folds, and we look down at the ace of clubs, king of hearts. Since we all know each other well, I'm going to take a line here that I normally wouldn't. I'm going to limp to under-rep my hand. I don't recommend this in a standard full-ring casino cash game, but with players who are very familiar with each other and short-handed, sometimes you have to go against GTO. The under-the-gun calls. The pot is 125, and the flop is the king of diamonds, 10 of diamonds, tray of spades. This is a perfect situation for an under-repped ace-king. We're going to lead out here. We make it 80 cents to go. The under-the-gun folds, but the plus one calls. The pot is 285, and the turn is the 10 of clubs. I believe this card hits my range more than his, as I could potentially have more 10s in my range. Now comes the question. Do we check or bet this? We decide on a bet. I want to bet on the larger side to make it look like I'm bluffing and to punish any flush draws he may have. We make it 225 to go. After some thought, our opponent calls. The pot is 735, and the river is the ace of spades. We slow down and check. The plus one bets $5. What's the move?
It's time for the VancePokerTrain.com Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast at antiupmagazine.com. If you haven't won something from us in the past year, you'll get a free membership to Advanced Poker Training, the world's number one poker training site. All right, this week's hand comes from RC, not the soda, like an actual real person, I think.
Oh.
Did you have RC when you grew up?
Oh, yeah, Royal Crown Soda, Royal Cola, or something like that, yep.
Yeah, yeah, but I think it was regional, or more popular in different regions, because I remember drinking it all the time growing up, and then when we moved down south here, mentioned people RC, and I'm like, what are you talking about?
Well, I remember it was, when we saw it, we thought, oh, I can't afford Coke.
Yeah, it was the budget. So
yeah, that's what we thought. I mean, no offense to them, but...
All right, let's see. All right, he says, this is from a home game that I play in weekly. The game is nine-handed. They play 2-5, no limit hold'em. Players commonly straddle to $10 or $15 under the gun. Everyone starts the game with 500, but players reload regularly when they are down or bust. And after a few hours, stacks are normally between 500 and 2,000. This hand was the next to last hand of the night, so we agreed to play one last rotation. Oh boy, that's always trouble for someone.
Man.
He said, I had to reload once, so I'm in the game for 900 total and currently sit with around 750. The villain in this hand was down 1,000 early, but has been on a roll for the last hour and has won some pots. His play style leans towards loose aggressive, and I've seen him make some pretty big hero calls and also some pretty large bluffs. He sits with around 1,400 to start the hand. We are six-handed at this point, as some players have busted and left. I'm in the big blind. The end of the gun straddles to 15. Everyone folds to the button who calls. The small blind, who is the villain, calls. And we look down to the six of spades, seven of spades.
Well, you know, in a situation like this, if I was in a regular cash game or something, I probably would play this hand, depending on what the straddler does. If I know, if this is somebody that just likes to check behind, just wants to get a bigger pot started and isn't one of those guys that just straddles. We talk about this all the time. If I think I can get away with just calling and getting to see a flop or 15 in a 2-5 game, that's fine with me, even though I'll be out of position. Doesn't matter. I mean, I'm just hoping to hit a big flop. And if I don't, well, I'm down a bunch tonight, so I took a chance on trying to get a bunch of it back. So I wouldn't mind a call here. If he decided to fold, I'd say it's probably tight, considering it's the end of the night, but I wouldn't fault him for folding either. I don't know about the raise part of it unless I'm positive that this guy, you know, just succumbs to fold, to raises when he's in the straddle. He has to wake up with a hand to actually call. So there, I guess you can go all three ways with this, but I would be inclined to just try to call and see a flop for 15. If the guy makes it like 50 to go, then I'm going to be kind of like, well, what's another 15 on top of the, you know, 400 I've already lost tonight or whatever. So
I could probably justify all three. I think the call is the best way to play this. Raise seems a little aggressive here for me. I like this hand in a game like this, but the raise seems a little too aggressive for me, particularly with the straddler to act after me.
Yeah.
And that we won't be in position. I mean, if the raise, if we believe the raise is going to get the straddler and the button out of the way, then that would be my argument for raising. If I don't believe that's going to happen, I don't think I want to make this pot any bigger with a hand that could flop big or I could get out cheaply, right?
Right.
Certainly, you know, it's not a great hand either, so it could be an easy fold, particularly if we think the under the gun is, or the straddler is usually raises, which, as we keep mentioning on the show, I don't know why you straddle if you don't raise, but whatever. But if he, you know, if he raises every time, then, you know, we know we're going to be playing this for more than 15. So that would be consideration to fold. But based on everything else, I think a call is in order here. This is a hand that could stack some folks. And hopefully the straddler will check and we'll get to this flop pretty cheaply. So.
Okay.
All right. That's what our hero does. He calls and this under the gun straddler checks his straddle. Again, why?
Wow. Well, here's the other thing, too, is that's that, you know what? It's funny that you say that, though, because why? Not why as in, duh, you're supposed to raise when you straddle, but why? Why didn't he this time? Especially when, let me see. Yeah, he was described as loose aggressive. So why isn't this guy raising his straddle like he's supposed to?
Loose aggressive is the villain who is a small blind.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Oh, that's right. Okay, so, yeah.
But that's all right. I'm going to excuse you there because there's so many people in this hand. Yeah. I mean, it's one of the reasons that you really do need a raise there as a straddler. Because now you just threw $15 in blind, and you've got three opponents now, and you've done nothing aggressive to make that $15 seem important to you.
Right.
That's what I don't get about it. So, I mean, I'm not a big on wanting to raise out of position, so that's why I don't – one of the reasons I don't – there's 4 million reasons why I don't straddle, but – that's one of the problems with it, is because you're out of position. And so now you've just effectively added another big blind to your stack.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, and that's the worst thing ever. I mean, no one likes to put blinds in, right? I'm like, if you could avoid a blind, you wouldn't put a blind in.
That's right.
It's just the rules. I mean, somebody has to put them in, so it moves around the table. But, all right, well.
Scott's rant is over. Let's move on.
Straddle rant there. Sorry, folks. All right, the flop is the 10 of hearts, 6 of clubs, a tray of diamonds, and small blind checks. And we are next.
This is interesting because I want to analyze kind of the pre-flop stuff again. If the under-the-gun straddler, he puts it, usually the straddlers do raise. So why did the small blind limp along and not fold, knowing that it's probably going to get to 45 or 50, you know, did he have the same kind of cards we did, or he's got suited connectors, or was he the type of guy that had a big hand and was waiting for someone to raise behind us, and it didn't happen? So now, yeah, we had a pair of sixes with a crappy kicker, but I'm not getting invested in this hand yet. I mean, a pair of sixes with no kicker versus somebody who limped in a straddled pot or a straddled hand. No, you know what I mean? There could be something big behind us. There could be something big ahead of us. I don't like this hand at all, and I am clearly just checking.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I don't like it at all. We hit a pair, but it's not why I was playing 7-6 suited for, was to hit a pair, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like betting this hand is what I mean. Yeah.
I wanted straight possibilities. I wanted flush possibilities, and really none of that happened. So at this point, this is a super easy check. Hope it checks around, and hope I pick up a six, maybe a seven, and then I can get active in this hand. But other than that, you know, I paid $15 to flop big, and a pair of sixes with a seven kicker is not big. So
yeah.
All right, our hero disagrees with us, Chris. He decides to bet to try to win the pot right here. He bets 35, hoping they would think I hit the 10 or a big blind special like 6-tray, or they just miss the flop and fold. Everyone folds to our villain in the small blind, who calls.
Okay, so this is scary because really there's no draw here other than 4-5 and then a gutter for, you know, 7-8 or 8-9 or something. So, I don't mind betting to see where you are, as we used to say 10 years ago. But in this case, I don't like betting. And I don't like a call either, because what's he really drawing to? Is he really drawing the 4-5 there and for a straight? Maybe. He's in the small blind. But would you really limp along when there's a straddler and a person left to act behind you?
Yeah, he might have, because we limped along with 7-6, so I don't think that's too much different than 4-5 here. So, I mean, I do think 4-5 is a legitimate holding here. There's lots of other legitimate holdings, too. But
two people behind us to act, though, it's kind of asking for trouble to just limp and pay 15 for nothing. So, I don't know. Maybe he's drawing, maybe he's not, but it scares me a little bit that we have a check call for $35 on a 10-6 tray rainbow board. Maybe he hit the 10, but... maybe he raises the 10 after it gets back to him, check raises to protect that hand against the 4-5 that could be in the big blind, you know, or something. So I don't know. Right now it's a little early to say. We could be ahead. We could be woefully behind. I don't like the bet though.
Well, the good thing is he didn't raise us here, so we're not put to a test right now. Right, so we aren't get that turn card, which is what you and I were trying to get to cheaply. So, there is that. The other good news is we got the other, we've halved the field, so we only have one opponent now instead of three, so there is that.
Yep.
But yes, but everything you said makes me a little worried about, you know, are we drawing dead here, which could be a possibility. At the very least, unless he's sitting on that 4-5, we are behind right now and need to improve. Good thing is we have position now, so we'll see what our opponent does on the turn. So we could get a free card out of this.
And it's hard for us because most of the time these hands are sent to us because we know they lost. Because that's why would they send it to us? Because they won. I mean, sometimes you send it because you win, because you either want to brag or because you're just so shocked by the way this person played and you want to see, you know, if there was a way you could have gotten more money out of it or whatever. But for the most part, you and I kind of go in with a biased opinion, knowing that these people probably lost the hand. So it's hard for us to just analyze it completely without, you know, any kind of slight. Because to me, right now, all I'm saying to myself is this guy's got a huge hand. He was hoping the straddler would raise preflop and didn't. And so now he's got an overpair or a set or something. And so that's what makes me think, you know, it's hand of the week. So it's tough. I know a lot of our comments are biased, but I don't know. I find it hard to bet there. And then when there's a call, I just feel like, we're going to get in trouble. And it's hard enough to feel that way because it's hand of the week.
Yeah.
You know?
All right. The turn is the six of diamonds. So our board now is 10 of hearts, six of clubs, tray of diamonds, six of diamonds, which gives us trips. And our opponent checks to us.
Okay. So... This person is telling us a story that they're drawing. It's the story that we're learning. But the other thing is, again, it's hand of the week, so you always worry that he's walking the dog. So that's generally the rule, is you have to figure it out. Is this person walking the dog, or is this person, you know, drawing the dog? You know, so I can't not bet three sixes. If I bet 1-6, I'm going to bet three sixes, you know. And again, if he was drawing, you'd want to bet because you don't want that straight to get there and your three of a kind gets wasted. At the same time, you're hoping now he's got like Jack 10 and he just, you know, whatever. But I'm going to have to bet. I mean, I guess I'll bet half the pot, whatever's in the pot. I don't know what's in the pot now.
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't been, it's 70 plus 60, so about 130-ish, I guess.
Yeah, so I'd bet probably half the pot, 60, 65.
So here's the good thing about our hero playing differently than we did. He took control of his hand on the flop and in a gin card game, right? The six is what we wanted. The seven would have been fine, but the six is really what we wanted, and it came. So there's absolutely no reason to slow down for me now. Now I need to bet and hope that our opponent has something lighter than us and makes a play at us, thinking that we're just trying to steal this pot when we're not. We got a legitimate hand now. Obviously, the worry is if you go back to, like, you know, he's sitting there with pocket tens, then we're, yeah, this does not make us feel any better. Although I guess we have outs now, one out. But yeah, we absolutely have to bet here. This is not slowing down for me. This is betting and letting him take a shot at me. So it's the best card in the deck for us. So
yeah, I guess it's scary to think, you know, it could be the other way. And if it is the other way, we're losing our stack, because I don't think I'm going anywhere to three sixes unless, you know, that straight card gets there and he bets into us, you know, then I just call or something. But other than that, I mean, three sixes, no one puts you on a six, whether you're in the blinds or not. And
again, let's think about what's going to happen here. So, you know, if we get to the river here and our villain has a real hand, he's going to bet then, and whatever it is, we're just going to call, right? I don't think we're going to race at that point because of our concerns here. So I think we're in a good spot here. So, but yeah, we'll see what happens here.
Okay.
All right. Harris says, wanting to get some value from my trips, I bet 75. Okay, so that's what we're back on the same page again. He says, like, I'm okay with just taking it down here. The villain thinks for a minute and calls again. Now around 280 in the pot. All right, so I guess this is what we're talking about. So now I'm assuming the villain's going to bet on the river, unless he really is on that 4-5 draw. But even then, if you're on the 4-5 draw and he's loose aggressive, that's the only way you're going to win the pot, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there's definitely going to be a bet coming from the villain here. So the river is a 5 of hearts, so the final board is 10 of hearts, 6 of clubs, tray of diamonds, 6 of diamonds, 5 of hearts. Villain thinks for a minute and checks. Oh, boy.
All right, so here's what's scary is, really, if you have 4-5, are you really calling 75 now to hit that straight when the board's paired and you could already be drawing dead? Something tells me we're in trouble. And I mean, I hope it's not 10 in the case 6. Why would somebody have called a straddle for with 10-6 and or 6 tray? You know, maybe 6 tray suited, if that's possible. You know, maybe it's something like 10-10.
But even like a 8-6 has a beat. 9-6, you know, some of those weird hands. I mean, if they were suited, I could almost see that with a loose aggressive player. So, and we keep discounting that somebody else has the K-6. So, yeah. And a lot of hands that beat us here.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. 8-6, 10-10. You know, they were hoping the undergun straddle would raise and then they'd get more money out of them. And it didn't happen. Now they flop the world and they're just walking a dog. You know, like the 8-6, you know, I guess could call our bet after that flop, you know, with middle pair. And then now it's turned third 6 and is still checking to us, hoping that, you know.
Or any 6. I mean, think like an 8-6.
Yeah.
I mean, 8-6 would be reasonable. I mean, it's not the hand that we ever talk fondly about on this show. But, you know, if you're loose aggressive, I mean, any ace is a good one. So
yeah. Suited 8-6, too.
There are a lot of 6 hands that have us beat as well, too. Yeah. To me, I think this is a gift. He checked to us. I'm going to check behind. I'm going to be quite happy with 280 coming back to me on the last rotation with a crappy starting hand. And if he's got us beat, I'm going to actually – I'll probably tip him $5 for not betting on the river. Give some money to him. So Easy check for me.
Yeah, I agree. Because, you know, other hands beat us, too. You know, we only made 3-6s. We didn't boat. So, you know, deuce-4 does beat us. 4-7 does beat us. It's possible deuce-4 is there suited. You know, and then, like you said, all of the 6s that are higher than ours beat us. Because all the rest of the cards were low, so you're going to have to play that kicker.
Beat us because they're boats.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, and then, so really, any 6 beats us, except for deuce-6. So, I mean, you know, and 4-6. So, I mean, you really need to just check behind here now and just be happy with what you got. You know, some people will be like, no, you got a value bet there, blah, blah, blah. But I don't think so. There's a lot going into this hand now that we've worked out between the straddler is what really makes us think about it. Because if the person had a huge hand he probably was hoping the straddler would raise and didn't, so now we're sitting on, you know, tens full and we're screwed. If the person, because why was he calling the whole way? You know, if he had a hand that needed to protect, he would have come alive somewhere, and he didn't. So with the third six, he might be convinced that we have a six. If he has a six, he might bet us now and say, hey, you know, and get more money out of us. He never did. He kept just calling. So I don't mind a check behind here either. I like that, actually.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Our hero bets 80, hoping for a call. The villain thinks for a minute and raises to 260. Who saw this coming? Our hands are up.
Man.
So my immediate thought was, fold ASAP. If you limp preflop and check calls every straight, then check raises every, he has to have me beat. But then I paused and started thinking of my way through the hand. What hands would he play this way? He's called the whole way, maybe a draw, 5-4, or a pair, and turned a diamond draw, maybe a 10 without a good kicker, 10-9 or 10-7 from the small blind. If he has something like ace-10, king-10, queen-10, jack-10, he would most likely have bet somewhere along the way. He probably just calls the river and possibly raised preflop. With any of these hands, he could fear that he's beat if he calls, knowing I most likely have a six and can only win by bluffing the river. Could he have a six as well? He could have me outkicked, or he could have something like 6-5 and river the boat. That would make sense, but I don't think he checks the river with those, fearing I finally check behind and misses a street of value in a good-sized pot after making a boat. Finally, does he have a boat? 5-5 makes no sense. With 10-10, I think he would have raised preflop and at least made a bet somewhere along the way. Trade kind of makes sense, but I don't think he raises the river because I have a 6 and possibly made a bigger boat. In the end, I decided his range had to be polarized, a monster or a stone-cold bluff. I mentioned before that I've seen him make some good bluffs. I decided he has enough bluffs in his range that I can't fold to a raise that size when I have the best hand and a decent amount of time. I make a crying call. Villain turns over 10-10, a nut boat, and wins a nice pot. Not sure why he didn't raise preflop, and he slow played it the whole way. I go home down 600 for the night, wondering why he didn't check the whole way, or snap fold to his check raise and go home. Everyone's talking about it as we close out the night, and most agree they are pretty much never folding there.
The 10-10... He mentioned earlier that why wouldn't he have raised preflop? But again, it all comes down to the straddler. If the straddler's the type of guy that constantly, you know, does what everyone expects him to do, then that's what he's hoping for. He's hoping that it's 15 already. He's already got, you know, I think he had a caller in there somewhere. And then he comes along. He's hoping the big blind comes along. And then it gets to the guy. And now that there's 45 or 60 in the pot, we're hoping that guy's going to make it 120. You know, because that's what they do, even though they never have a hand. And then he comes back to him. He's like, okay, 120, I shove. And now I steal that 120 from you and the other 45 that's in the pod. That's not mine. And so it's like, okay, that's where 10-10 comes in. And that's where it could have been plausible. And it obviously was plausible. But for me, when hands are polarized like that, either a bluff or I'm crushed, I go with the crushed for that amount of money. It's to me, it's like, okay, I'm already down so much money in this game. Do I really need to be broke now over three sixes and a horrible kicker that I probably shouldn't have played in the first place, but I did play it and here we are. So to me, any six beats us except for two six scenarios, you know, do six and what, 4-6 is what we said. So no, even that, right? Four. Yeah, because only 3, 4, 5, 6. So, okay. So, really, there are a lot of hands beat us. You know, it's not just the polarizing thing of him either beating us or not. It's that there are a lot of hands that beat us. Any six beats us, basically. And a straight beats us. And pocket tens beats us. 10-6 beats us. If they're in the blind, especially, they could have anything in a straddle hand. Who knows? So, I would have leaned toward a fold there. Or check. Actually, I would have checked and then called.
To me, the telltale sign here was if he wants to bluff, he would bluff on the river first. He would ask first, right?
Right.
Because if you're going to bluff here, you're not going to wait for it to become more expensive, the bluff. So, and by checking, we gave, and then we bet, we made it more expensive for him to bluff there. Why would you do that? That makes no sense to me. So, now, if he would have bet out first, that's when I have to start thinking, hey, this is 5-4, he missed his straight, and now he's buying the pot. That would be plausible. But the fact that he checked, essentially, with a weak hand, now he's giving up. But then he decides, oh, okay, I guess I'm not going to give up. You gave me an opportunity to to buy it at a higher rate, it doesn't make any sense.
So. Exactly. Because I was going to say, you're exactly right. Because if he knows he can't win the hand without betting, checking and check behind knows he can't win. So now you bet now. You don't say, oh, I'll have a third chance to win later. No, there's no other chance to win if he checks behind you. So you need to bet out if you're going to bluff. There's no way that's a bluff, check, raise, bluff. There's just no way.
Yep.
That stinks.
So again, it's more that checking behind on the river would have saved you to 280?
Yeah.
What do you bet?
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
So that's really, I mean, I think that was the analysis we made, is there's just too many ways you're going to lose there. A good chance that you were ahead, though. So, I mean, checking behind the river, I would have rather won this pot without betting than not getting max value out of it. So,
well, the good news is you could turn your original email into an NFT that you sent us and try to find this guy and sell it to him for like $500 and get your money back. I'm Chris Costanza.
And I'm Scott Locke.
We'll see you at the table.
Anti-Up is a production of AntiUpMagazine.com. Contact the show at podcast@AntiUpMagazine.com. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to advertising@AntiUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.